History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are still stories out there that we cannot allow to go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we end up learning so much. Not only are we educated and entertained, but we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. For 15 years now, I've had the privilege of meeting World War II veterans all across this great nation. And I have to admit that sometimes I get so caught up in that rhythm of tracking down a new vet week after week after week that I neglect to pause, step back, and look at the big picture of how many Americans were involved in truly saving the world all those years ago, and how many incredible perspectives on it we've heard right here. The upcoming 75th anniversary of the Normandy invasion has afforded me that opportunity. I've been receiving calls from organizations looking to travel D-Day veterans back to France for the anniversary, or trying to find surviving D-Day vets just to talk to. So it made me think, with D-Day occupying so much of the national and worldwide consciousness over this next month, what if we revisited some of those Normandy experiences we've heard about over the years from men and women who were there? On land, at sea, in the air, jumping from the air to the ground behind enemy lines, there were so many different ways those young people contributed to a costly but crucial victory. And over the weeks leading up to that anniversary, we are going to do just that, starting with this program. In Normandy on June 6, 2019, President Donald Trump will be taking part in the 75th commemoration. So many of his predecessors from both sides of the aisle have done the same. President Reagan's speech on the 40th anniversary is one of his most famous. But the first president to address the nation about D-Day was Franklin D. Roosevelt. And it wasn't so much a speech as it was a prayer. But here's what you would have heard if you were listening to the radio on June 6th, 1944.
My fellow Americans, last night when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment that troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph. They will be sore tried by night and by day, without rest, until the victory is won. The darkness will be rent by noise and flame. Men's souls will be shaken with the violences of war. For these men are lately drawn from the ways of peace. They fight not for the lust of conquest. They fight to end conquest. They fight to liberate. They fight to let justice arise and tolerance and goodwill among all thy people. They yearn but for the end of battle, for their return to the haven of home. Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, thy heroic servants, into thy kingdom. And for us at home, fathers, mothers, children, wives, sisters, and brothers of brave men overseas, whose thoughts and prayers are ever with them, help us, Almighty God, to rededicate ourselves in renewed faith in Thee in this hour of great sacrifice. Many people have urged that I call the nation into a single day of special prayer. But because the road is long and the desire is great, I ask that our people devote themselves in a continuance of prayer. As we rise to each new day, and again when each day is spent, let words of prayer be on our lips, invoking thy help to our efforts. Give us strength, too. Strengthen our daily tasks to redouble the contributions we make in the physical and the material support of our armed forces. And let our hearts be stout to wait out the long travel, to bear sorrows that may come, to impart our courage unto our sons, wheresoever they may be. And, O Lord, give us faith. Give us faith in Thee, faith in our sons, faith in each other, faith in our united crusade. Let not the keenness of our spirit ever be dulled. Let not the impacts of temporary events, of temporal matters of but fleeting moment, let not these deter us in our unconquerable purpose. With thy blessing, we shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country, and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace, a peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done, Almighty God. Amen.
President Franklin D. Roosevelt on June 6, 1944. And you know, 5 years ago, Congress passed and President Obama signed a bill authorizing the addition of that prayer to the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. It also stipulated that no federal funds could be used in that process. So the nonprofit Friends of the World War II Memorial Organization is raising the money to accomplish that. And if you would like to contribute, I have a link for you at hometownheroesradio.com. There you can also access the complete original interviews with the three D-Day veterans you're going to hear from today. First is the late Phil Reed, who is being toasted this weekend in Portland, Oregon, where they're holding the National LCI Reunion. LCI stands for Landing Craft Infantry. And no one was more dedicated to preserving the history and contributions of the LCI than Phil, who at his self-built automotive museum in Southern California even had a donation box to try to restore an LCI in Oregon. He passed away in September at the age of 98, but what an incredible legacy he left. And while most of the D-Day veterans we've met here on Hometown Heroes came ashore at Omaha Beach or Utah Beach, Phil and the LCI-35 were somewhere else. He was one of 13 children from northern Michigan. He originally wanted to be a B-17 tail gunner, and he gave up his deferment from working at Douglas Aircraft to join the Navy. Here's how Phil described the LCI he was on June 6, 1944.
It was 158 feet long,
mm-hmm.
20 feet wide, flat bottom.
It's not very big.
No, 158, and we carried 200 troops. It was really loaded. It's Sword Beach. We carried British commandos. We had a lot of, I forget how many ships we had in that flotilla, but we gave the British 10 ships to put their commandos on. We landed at Sword Beach, so it's a funny thing that happened. Last 2 years ago, I was over in France, and we cut out a restaurant. My niece took me over there, and I seen this soldier coming down. And he had all these badges on. I told my niece, I said, I'm going to talk to that guy. So I got talking to him. And he says, you know, he says, the funny thing is, I was on an American ship. He said, I can't figure out how we got on an American ship. So I told him, I knew exactly how he got on there. I said, you may have been on my ship. I don't know. There was 10 of us.
Uh-huh.
But he had all these badges and he had his uniform on. But he landed at Sword Beach.
Which is exactly where you guys were dropping them off.
And, yeah.
You know, so much has been said about that day, and it's been called the longest day. But how long of a day was it for you? Where did it start?
Not very long. I tell you, we landed up on a beach, unloaded the troops, and our anchor cable got stuck in the propeller there, screw. And so we chopped it off. And let it go. But then a British ship hit the same thing. British ships was the same as ours, only their conning towers was a little bit lower.
Mm-hmm.
We towed them back to New Haven, England.
I don't want to interrupt, Phil, but you're describing this, and it seems to me there were probably a few other things going on there.
Oh, there was. A lot of things going on.
I mean, you must have been hearing things, seeing things.
Yeah.
Worried that you might be feeling things?
Yeah, that gun is still up there in France on the beach. That big, I don't know how many millimeters it is, but it's still up there because when I went there last year, and I went there and saw it, but they were shooting down at us. But for some reason or another, they never did hit us. And you don't know who they hit because everything is going on. And
were you up topside and seeing all this, or where were you while this was happening?
Yeah, I was on top because we pull the ramps out for the soldiers to go down. Had a little gasoline engine, one on port, one on starboard. Well, nobody could get them things going, and so I was up there getting them started.
And I know this was your life, and you lived it, and you may not think it's as big a deal as the rest of us, but on this day where world history changed, where so many guys paid with their lives on those beaches, you're right at that beach trying to let these British troops off so they can go fight for freedom, and they can't even get off because the door won't go down to let them off.
Yeah.
And you had to fix it.
Yeah.
So how'd you fix it?
I don't know. I just got it started. There's two of them, one on each side.
So it's like fixing a lawnmower or something?
Yeah. That's what they were, actually.
Uh-huh.
They pull the ramps out, and then when you hit the beach, you drop them down. You release them, and they drop down.
Obviously, you were cool and calm under pressure having to fix this while there's gunfire going around and all this chaos.
Yeah.
But were you scared at all? Were you nervous?
No, you don't. It don't bother you. You know, you got a job to do, and you just got to do that job.
You know, there's so many ships there. The enemy has so many forces. But where you guys dropped these British troops off, how close was the enemy fire coming to you guys on the ship?
Just up on the hill.
And they were shooting at your ship?
Yeah. Well, not the ours, all of them. They were lined up.
Yeah. So you could have been hit.
Yeah.
Sure.
You're lucky you didn't get hit.
So you dropped those guys off, and that was the only trip you took that day?
No, we went back. Yeah, but we made 25 other trips carrying them back and forth for days that followed.
Uh-huh. Well, and I'm sure that each time you came back to Sword Beach, you probably saw a little different scene.
It was, yeah. Then they had the, what do you call them, where they built, they towed those, and they made it kind of a circle. And when you unload the troops from then on, You just came over and went out up on the artificial harbor.
You're talking about those artificial mulberry harbors, they call them. You can still find remains of those if you visit Normandy today. You have a plexiglass-encased model of your ship, the LCI-35. It's got the number painted right there. And on top, there's a little donations box.
Well, that's the donation to the ship is being restored up in Portland, Oregon. It's all done on the outside, inside, except it needs a new bottom on it. Well, we have the steel and everything, but we're trying to get the money to get it in dry dock and put a new steel on, and then we can drive it.
That was the late Phil Reed's dying quest, a way to preserve the history of LCIs on D-Day and beyond. And as they gather in Portland, Oregon this weekend for the first national LCI reunion since his passing, they are closer than ever to making that a reality. If you would like to support the effort, I have a link posted for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Up next, a man who came ashore at Omaha Beach on June 6, 1944. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, counting you down toward the 75th anniversary of D-Day by hearing from people who were there. June 6, 1944 would be the first ever day of combat for a young man named David McCoy. He had escaped Oklahoma's Dust Bowl and made it to California, but 75 years ago he was with the 1st Infantry Division's 18th Regiment.
Well, the idea we had in combat was that we weren't going to make it home. That's the way we felt, the way we was involved in the battle and everything else. We just figured do the best we can because we didn't think we'd make it home. We were notified to prepare to go on a certain day, and of course then they called it off because the weather was too bad. And it's a good thing we didn't go that particular day because the Germans was thinking we were coming that particular day, and we didn't. So we went the next day, but the next day it was kind of rough because a lot of the guys got sick on the ship. I was on what they call a LST, where you load a lot of equipment and stuff, only a few troops on it. You get over there and they drop a ramp and you go off into the water and get onto the beach. So it was a rough deal going over that day we did, but the Germans had already moved out some of their troops because we didn't come the day we were supposed to, so it kind of helped us a bit.
Yeah, and there was another twist of fate that would help you out in your situation, but you mentioned driving a truck off the LST. What kind of truck was that? What was it carrying? How big was it?
It's an armored half-track ammunition carrier. I was loaded with ammunition. So I had to get off and get onto the beach, and I had to wait on the beach to make sure I got my four guns off, my four artillery pieces, if they got stranded in the water, because the water was still pretty deep, because when I got off, it come all the way up into my floorboard. And I had to wait on the sand to make sure I got my four guns off. If you understand what 4th of July is, it was 4th of July and then some.
And I want to touch on that. Let's come back to it. But before that, you were initially supposed to be one of the first ships getting there? You're supposed to be part of the first wave of American forces hitting the beach at Omaha Beach on D-Day?
That's correct. We're supposed to have been in there, but we couldn't get in because the Navy would drop the anchor, and when he went to the end, he'd tell us to get off. Well, the first time he dropped it, we put it one big truckload of ammunition off, and it went completely under. So they pulled out again, came back in the second time. We let some guys test the water, and they went under. So we pulled out, and our commander told the Navy commander, you either get us in this time, or we're going to throw you overboard. I mean, we had to get in. So the third time was when my eye came off. Then I got off, like I say, and then I had to wait to get my four artillery pieces off.
So this is about, about noontime or early afternoon on D-Day?
No, it was just before noon.
Just before noon. And the people who did get in there at 6 o'clock in the morning got a very rude welcome, and it sounds like it wasn't very pleasant for you. You said 4th of July, and I think that tells us a little bit. Can you give us a sense of what you saw and what you heard as you drove that truck off that LST?
Well, even before I drove it off, we heard all the shells. The Germans did a lot of airburst. It was terrible before we got off, and hated to get off and go into all of that. But
and for people at home that weren't there and don't get what you're saying when you say an airburst, explain to us what that is and why that's so deadly and dangerous.
Well, it's a big shell that they fire at you, and it blows up in the air so that all the shrapnel will hit whoever's below, you know. Before I got off, I had binoculars, and I was looking over at one of the troop ships that was sitting there. It had got in the air, and the tide went out, and it was setting up in the sand, and the troops were getting off, and I saw these troops going down the ramp, and they was falling off in the water about halfway down the ramp, and I kept looking, and I saw something, and then I spotted a machine gun up on the hill that was shooting the troops as he's coming down the ramp. I told my commander, and he called the destroyer escort that was right around us, and they spotted the machine gun, and they fired three shells. One shell went above it, one went below it, and one blew it up. We could see it blow up, and it set up there shooting our troops as they was coming off the ship.
Well, and I know you're not looking for the glory or a pat on the back here, but it sounds like you probably saved a lot of lives by spotting that and pointing it out to them. And that's hard to talk about, I know, when you think about that. Maybe your own life was one of the ones saved in that process.
When I got my half-track off onto the sand and was just waiting, I was under heavy fire at the time. While I was sitting there waiting, one of the troops was laying over there rolling, and I got out and went over and asked, are you hit? Are you hurt? And I noticed it was a one-star general, and he was on our ship when I didn't know he was on there. And I said, are you hurt? No, I got to get this life belt off. We got to leave it on the beach. And I said, USB, get the hell out of here. So I kicked him and told him go. And he run over to that ship. And just as I got my guns off, that ship blew up. So I don't know whether that general got killed or not. I never seen him after that. But we were getting heavy fire as I was coming off, real heavy. And some of the troops that we had on ship with us, they would get on the barrels of the gun as it's coming off and ride. And some of the airburst knocked them off, and some of them got run over, and some of them got killed as it was coming off.
And I'm just trying to imagine, and I see the emotion in your eyes all these years later. I'm trying to imagine how you keep going in a situation like that. How do you, I mean, you said that you didn't expect to make it through, but that kind of cements it for you, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure did. I was concerned because the half-track was solid armor, but if I would have got airburst right over it, with all the ammunition I was carrying, it was a death trap.
You would have blown here to smithereens. So you were unable to get on the beach and unload all your guns?
Yes. We got all the guns off of the beach. We got them up into position, and we pulled up the valley and got up on a hill and got settled down for the evening. I pulled a half track up on a hill and found a spot, and I dug like a grave. And then I drove my front wheels of my half track right over the grave, and then I slid under the grave, and I slept in there overnight. And I was still getting bullets fired at me, but they couldn't hit me because I was down in there. There was a German across a hedgerow that during the night. He'd fire, and the bullets would hit the hedgerow, and it'd go poop, poop. And at daylight, our troops come by and shot the guy just over the hedgerow. But then they go on to a little building that was there, And there was a person in that little building that was directing the traffic for the Germans on the beach. And they shot the person. After they shot the person, they turned him over, and it was a woman, a German woman, directing all the fire on the beach. They had guns sitting in there about 5 miles in, shooting the big shells on the beach.
Well, and we're getting a taste of why June 6, 1944 has been called the longest day. And when you describe where you spent that night, and you talked about digging the grave and then parking your half track over it so nothing could get in that. Did someone teach you to do that, or is that just something you thought up?
Oh, that's something you do. You either dig a foxhole or you dig a grave, something you can get in. So I thought the easiest way was to dig that so I could lay in it at night. And I pulled a half track front wheels over it because the back wheels are all like caterpillar wheels. Right. So I had a good place to stay overnight.
But I imagine you didn't get much sleep.
No, I didn't get much sleep. I got a little bit of shut-eye, but not much.
And how do you wake up the next day ready to do anything after you've endured that? I mean, when they say the longest day, is that what it felt like to you?
Yeah, it was a long day, all right. I don't think we even was concerned about it. It was just so much action going on. And, of course, I didn't have any trouble waking up because all the fire going up all around me that next morning at daylight. So no problem.
I don't want to make you dwell on the stuff that's difficult to dwell on, but for those of us who weren't there and didn't experience it, what was the most difficult thing for you to witness that day?
I think the biggest problem was seeing so many bodies. It was a real disaster. Yeah. Most of my buddies were gone. Later on, about a week after we got in and so forth, well, maybe 2 weeks, I was still driving a half track, and on my half track, I had a machine gun, a 50 caliber and a 30 caliber. The chaplain got on with me, and we were going to see about burying some bodies. So we pulled up this one place and got out, and we dug a grave for this body, and we was getting ready to put him in it. We had his tag and his helmet we was going to put on a stick there. We got ready to roll him in, and all hell broke loose. There was a bunch of Germans dug in on the hedgerow over on the side that our troops already passed by, and they started firing at us. And the chaplain says, "Hell with that Heinle, let's get out of here." So we left him, and we went and got in the half track, and they was firing at us. I get the 30 caliber machine gun and started firing back. 30 caliber don't do any good. So I rolled a 50 caliber around, and I fired it, and they Germans came out from the hedgerow. I think is about 10 or 12 of them come out and surrendered. We held them there and called for backup, and they came and took them back. And then later after that, I went on up a ways further with our tanks. I think we had six tanks, and we was pulling into this field, and we was going to go in and park in the field. We get inside of there and run right into a big old Panther tank, and we had to get the hell out of there. And as we go out, our troops loaded up on the tanks, and the tanks come out, and they spun so fast in the road that one of the machine gunners in one of the tanks got thrown over, and he pulled the trigger, and he shot some of the soldiers on the tank in front of us. And I went out with a half track and tore up a bunch of communication lines as I was getting the hell out of there. Then it wasn't long after that until the commander's driver got injured, and the commander didn't have a driver, so nobody wanted to drive him because his Jeep has to stay right on the front line. So I told him if they get somebody to drive my death trap, I would take over. So I took over driving for the commander.
So you preferred driving the Jeep, even if you were on the front lines, to driving that half track?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, it was tough, but I enjoyed it more than I did driving a half track.
I know that this is all, at this point, every day probably is new experiences for you and things you've never seen before, but being with the regimental commander like that, did you get a different perspective on what was going on and what the war looked like to you?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. I was involved with every bit of it. Sometimes I would be in a place where he'd tell me, "Don't you move until I call you." And I didn't get along with the captain or the major, and they was always trying to get after me. Every time they turned around, they'd get after me. And, of course, I would go to the old man, which my commander, and tell him what's happened. And when I'd see them get out of line, I'd tell the commander, and he'd go over and chew them out, and they knew what was going on. So we had a battle between the major and the captain. The major was a big guy with a big goatee. All he'd do is pat his foot and twist his goatee and say, Corporal McCoy, you do this, and, you know. So he sent me on a deal one time. I almost got killed, and the commander, oh, man, he got after him.
Almost got killed. That sounds like another one of your close calls, huh?
Yeah, they hit my Jeep, blew a tire, knocked a tree down across my Jeep, and I managed to get away.
How'd you pull that off with a tree down over your Jeep?
Well, with the four-wheel drive, I managed to get out from under it, but still I had a flat tire, so I finally got down under a railroad track and had to put on a spare tire.
Well, see, I thought you were going to tell us that you were such a great driver that you had the same Jeep the entire way through the rest of the war.
Yeah.
Trying to be lighthearted with stuff that's still painful. I apologize, but you had three Jeeps?
Lost three Jeeps. Yeah, got all blown up, but luckily we didn't get hurt. The last one, like I say, P-51 and 47s were told to shoot anything in the area. And we had smoke screens and flares and everything else, and they came down and hit our Jeep. But the old man and I was in a ditch, so we were okay. So we didn't get hurt.
I realize this could be a needle in the haystack here, but of all the situations like that where it came close to your number being called, what's the one that took your breath away the most, or the one you think back on now and say, man, I was really fortunate to survive that?
Well, there was so many of them. The one that really got me was we were searching a house. I started over to the window to raise the window, and one of my guys knocked me down. And I, what the hell are you knocking me down for? He says, see that booby trap? So if I'd opened the window, I'd have got hit with a booby trap. Well, then as I go out the door, they had gone out, and just as I stepped out, a mortar landed right beside of me at the door, but it was one of our mortars that hit the roof and slid off, and it was a dud. And they had to move me. I couldn't move. They had to come and get me.
I'd be frozen stiff, too, and I've had a few other veterans tell me stories like that where a dud landed right next to them. I imagine you're frozen there because you're still waiting for it to go off, right?
Oh, it scared me. I couldn't move. It's one of those things.
When you finally realize that it is a dud, and that you dodged that bullet, literally, what goes through your mind? Are you giving thanks to somebody? Are you just taking a deep breath, a sigh of relief? What do you do?
I don't really think about it. I know it's just one of those things. If I go, I go. And, you know, you're in combat, and you never know when it's going to go. We were standing around behind the openings on a 105 Hollister, one of the artillery pieces, and a bunch of us just standing there talking, and one of the buddies said, I'm going to take a nap, and he laid over there and went to sleep. All of a sudden, in come shells. Wow, big air burst, and it didn't hit any of us, but we said, hey, he didn't even wake up. So we go over and pull the cover off of him, and he's all blown up. And that's how close it came to us. Just a lot of things like that happen. I was in so many different places to where that I'm just lucky to be here.
So many D-Day veterans would echo those sentiments from David McCoy from the 1st Infantry Division. Over the weeks ahead, we're going to be hearing from soldiers, sailors, paratroopers, and more who experienced the longest day firsthand. But straight ahead, someone who had to care for the wounded on June 6, 1944. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Over the next month, you're going to hear so much about D-Day, Operation Overlord, and the invasion of Normandy as we approach the 75th anniversary of that day that changed the world. It certainly changed the life of a young Navy corpsman out of Brooklyn, New York, named Jack Gutman. Before the invasion, he had helped set up Navy Base Hospital 12 in England, and he was one of about 50 from that unit, Special Navy Advance Group 56, recruited to accompany troops ashore and handle casualties.
We got the call, our group, and as I said, we were under deep secrecy. They made up a lot of fake things, like for Calais, They made it look like Calais was going to be the landing place.
All the way down to, like, inflatable tanks and stuff like that.
They had inflatable tanks and sound effects and trucks. I mean, that was amazing. Now, I found this all out later, the messages they were sending out, and it was brilliant. God bless Eisenhower and his staff, I mean, and what they did. Well, it turned out they got us, and they said, okay, you're not to go back to the base. We're loading up and stuff. And they put us on this APA. They had a lot of ships. We were going somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I've had apprehensions that it was going to be something big. What the Germans saw on the 6th when they, like, come up and all that, there were 5,000 ships, 4,500 landing craft. There was 11,000 planes of various sorts, and there was 150,000 men were going to hit 5 beaches. Ours was going to be Utah and Omaha. I was planned for Utah, as I thought, you know, but there was a lot of current, and we drifted. So I know we went off close to Omaha, between those two or near there, because the casualties were horrendous there. So what happened, the water was very choppy. We started coming down the nets, and we lost a couple guys that went off the ropes in between the LCVPs, that's the landing crafts, in between.
So you're just trying to get from the APA down to the LCVP, and guys are falling and drowning.
When you're climbing, as soon as you get down to where the boat is going up and down.
Sure.
I mean, huge waves. They get you on the up thing, and you got to jump in, and the guys catch you and bring you in the boat. Some guys let go too soon, and when it was on there, and they went in between the boat and the ship with the heavy packs on their back, they went straight down. They couldn't get the packs off enough time. And so we lost some men doing that. I mean, one was on the net that I was coming down, and I just couldn't believe that. I mean, that was my first shock.
Ugh.
I mean, I had thought of things that I was going to see Paul, but as we came in and we get into the LCVPs and the water is very rough, and all of a sudden you see the cannons going off, I mean, from the ships, the shells.
Yeah.
When you're close enough where you can see as you know, you're going bivouacking around until your wave come in. First, second, third, fourth wave, those guys are the forces that go in. They caught it badly. My job is just to take care of the wounded. So we're like in a 14th wave or something like that, or I don't know, because we're in to take care of the wounded. We're not in for the shooting or action. Carried a 45, no rifles. You carry medical pack 45. Mm-hmm. Same thing in the Pacific. When I see the shells hitting the beach, I said to myself, there isn't going to be a thing alive on that beach. It just won't be. When it came our time, when we went in, you hear planes going over and so forth. You figure, oh, well, this is it. I mean, it's going to be a cakewalk. They're going to drop all those bombs. Unfortunately, Paul, these bunkers, big German bunkers were up there where they could shoot down on their beaches. They had a machine gun, could shoot off 150 bullets a minute.
Yeah.
When they went to drop the bomb, it was cloud cover, and they could not see the beach of the bunkers. So they were told, which I found out, they were told, when you think you're near the beach, count three and drop the bombs, because they didn't want to hit the guys down there.
Yeah, not the Allies coming in.
Right, Allies. So what happened, all the bombs dropped on the other side about 2 miles in. It was almost by the time they dropped, the bombs hit. Nothing hit the bunkers. There was some shelling that the ships got that took care of some things there.
Yeah, you can still find those craters if you go there
right,
today.
Right, yeah. And then what happens, you got all of those guys that were coming in on the first, second, third, wherever, they just, some never got a shot off. Now, one of the problems was they had these big girders in the water and other obstacles. Let me clarify something. When you go in for an invasion, you're LCVP or your landing craft, you go right up to the beach, and then the thing drops down and you run off onto the beach. That's the normal pattern. That's what you practice for. But the Germans had all of these barriers there, plus landmines and everything else. They had to stop. So we had to stop way out there and wade in water up to our chests. When the machine guns started going off on this thing here, the guys panicked. A lot of guys were seasick. They were throwing up over each other. It was a mess. But they leaped off the side of the boat instead of waiting for the ramp to go down. And the water was so deep there, with the heavy pack, if they couldn't get the pack off, they drowned. Mm. Never got a shot off. It was like a nightmare. Rommel had set up 35,000 mines on the beaches with the barbed wire. They were supposed to get these tanks that were supposed to come in and the demolition crews that makes the path so the guys can go right through. The water was so rough and they could not come all the way up to the beach, you see. They dropped the thing so the tank could roll off. So they had these devices where the tank would be on that were made special for them, with a little motor in the back, and the tank would go up close to it. But when the water was so rough, it flipped the tank. The guys drowned right into the tank if they couldn't get out. We were talking about nightmares. That was one of the big nightmares that happened. Did not plan on it. It was a great idea, but that's what it was. So no big tanks hit so they could clear the beaches. So when I'm talking to anyone, I tell people, I said, if you watch Saving Private Ryan, the movie, they portrayed it the best that I've ever seen, but it was only like half the, what it was, because the only thing it did show, it was vivid and very accurate. But what they didn't show was all the body parts. And when I think of it, that's what got me. And then you got these guys on the beach wounded when you finally land on the beach. And guys are screaming, Mama, Mama. And then they look at you and then they say, Doc, am I going to live? And you have to lie to them because you know who's got, if they're going to die or not. And all, and it becomes a, like a nightmare. And you're in survival mode. And then you're always thinking in your mind, did I do the right thing? When I gave him that morphine shot to ease his pain and all, did I do enough? When I patched this up here, did it work okay? All these things spin in your mind, and all you're doing is going from one to the other. And then somebody says, well, you know, you're out in the open. What were some of the barriers? And that was like some of my nightmares that I went through in post-traumatic stress afterward. What you had to do sometime, if you had a guy and you had to drag him along to try to take care of him, you had another body that was dead, a American soldier, a kid. Excuse me. God, it keeps remembering me back. That you're using as a protection. It was like hell. I mean, hell.
So to try to save one injured soldier, you had to use a deceased American soldier as a shield.
Yeah, because there's not enough barriers there. Whatever girders or what you could hide behind or drag over there or dig in the sand or whatever you could, it was just horrible. And that was the way it was. I was on the beach the whole time. I think we were on about 6 or 7 hours, you know. But the bodies in the water floating around, I mean, guys laying around, it was just a horrible, horrible thing. And then what happened, I kept thinking, especially looking at the body parts, is that I thought quickly, could be like my brother or a friend. There's a father that'll never go home. There was a son that'd never go home. You see all this, and that all stays with you. Not at that time, it builds up in your head. And people constantly always said to me, because after that invasion was over, and I evacuated him, we got him back to the ships, and when we had enough, we took him back to the hospital that we had. So we were on the beach that time. Thank God we did it, and thank God for the men, the guys that died. And I remember people who used to say to me, have you ever gone over there to Normandy or any of these places? And I said, no, I didn't want to even face it because, see, the things that was happening to me after that invasion was, and Paula, my daughter, asked me once when I was writing my book, what was your post-traumatic stress like? And I said, well, it's different with each person. It was just horrible. She said, well, don't you think your readers would like to know that? And I said, okay. So I finally sat down very reluctant about it because it was very traumatic for me. And when you're writing it, I mean, I'm crying because I'm visualizing all these things that happened. But what you see in my post-traumatic stress, I see the invasion, it'll happen some flashes. A lot of times when you're relaxing or going to sleep, especially sleeping, where you see the invasion over and over again, it keeps happening, but it's magnified. And you see the guy screaming, Mama, Mama, and the wounded, and you see the body parts. Everything's magnified. The shelling, everything is big. It's like a nightmare. And I remember the same thing happened, like Normandy was one thing. Okinawa was another thing that was very devastating.
There's a fair amount of time between, and we're talking June of 44 to April of 45.
That's right.
And in between, you're in England at the hospital? At what point did you move to the Pacific?
What happened, I went after we evacuated the guys there.
Yeah.
And it turned out, by the way, in Normandy, we lost 9,000 men. Just a horrible thing. Well, I took care of them. I was at the hospital there for 2 months after the invasion, taking care of all the wounded there. Ironically, there was a guy that I patched up on the beach. He got shot here.
Right,
and there was a lot of blood, you know, and everything. And so I remember patching him up and giving him a shot. And he said, Doc, I'll tell you one thing. At least I'm going to go home, you know. And I said, yeah, you're going to make it home, you know. And he wound up in the hospital. Now, he was an officer. When I got back there, they sent me after the other thing. And I still couldn't tell the guys at my thing that where I had been. It was still all secret.
So the people who stayed behind at the hospital.
The guys there, even some of my buddies that I had, I just couldn't tell them. I said, let me know when. They said, we'll tell you. And I could not say anything because I figured court-martial. Even though it was over now. But we took care of him and we got the wounded. Now, this officer, I wound up in officer's ward there, taking care of the wounded. He was there. And that's another thing that bothered me. Where he got shot, it sealed off so no blood was going down the leg and all. Mm. It sealed some artery or whatever it was there. And they had to amputate his leg just above the knee. So when I saw him there, I'll never forget his name. His name was Pat Prendeville. So we got to talking, and he was going to get ready to go home, though. The other thing that happened, there was another guy I took care of in that officer's ward. He was visualizing as he was in a sort of semi-coma. He was talking about the battle on Normandy. Well, he got shot. And he was losing spinal fluid. And when you lose spinal fluid, the doctor had always told me he doesn't have much longer to live. I got to talking to him. He told me he had a wife and a kid and that he's looking forward to going home. And I got to know him and it became so personal. And then he started going through this delirium. And then he would start talking. He would be talking very fast. Then he would start going like, oy, 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 okay, oy, 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 oy. All this gibberish. It was like nothing. And then finally, he died. Now, if a guy dies on your watch when you're taking care of him, I happen to be on duty when he died. This is the crazy thing, and I had to do it 4 times. You have to pack every cavity in his body with cotton. But it was not something I always talk about, but it was something that was just very traumatic for me. So you see, Paul, all these things just built up. So after I was there for a couple of months doing all of this and going through all of that thing and remembering and going through the flashbacks because I started getting them when I started sleeping, but I thought this is something they didn't know anything about post-traumatic stress. All they knew is they called it shell shock. I figured I had to live with it. And I figured when I get home, maybe it'll all be over. Now, I also thought, now that I got leave to go home for 30 days to see my family in New York, when I got the leave, I was wonderful, had a good time, and I thought, this is going to be better because I'm in a different atmosphere. Flashbacks kept going. It was scary. I said, if I go to the doctors, they're going to... I thought they put me in a mental institution, honestly, for what I was going through.
That's something Jack Gutman dealt with for decades before finally getting help. And he's written all about that process in his book, One Veteran's Journey to Heal the Wounds of War.
I wanted to express what I was going through, the good and bad, and then let people know that they don't have to go through a war. They don't have to go through all the stuff I went through. People go through it with marriage problems and everything else. When I speak at some groups and their couples, I tell them this. We spend so much time thinking the grass is greener on the other side. But if you would water the grass you got, you'd be surprised how much greener it would get. So give love and you get love back. Pretend your spouse is like a cup. Fill it full of love, and all that overflows is yours.
Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story so candidly and for writing it down in this book, One Veteran's Journey to Heal the Wounds of War. It's one veteran's journey. It's your story.
Yeah.
But you know as well as I do, it's a parallel journey for so many veterans.
Absolutely.
And I get the sense that's another reason you wrote this book, to help them.
I plead to you veterans that are going through post-traumatic stress or any problem due to war or whatever it may be, get help.
Jack Gutman continues to proclaim that message far and wide at age 93. You can link to his book and full-length interviews with all the D-Day veterans you heard from today at hometownheroesradio.com. Next time, we're going to meet more Americans who were part of that monumental day nearly 75 years ago. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.